Tighten this down. Can't get these. Can't get these screws nice and tight. All right, that should about do it. Now I just gotta power them on. All right, sweet. Now all I gotta do is upload all the No More Kings albums into his AI database. Awesome. Robo Petey, play Obey the Groove. I am alive, I am alive, I am alive. No, Robo Petey, that's the wrong song. Play Obey the Groove. Steve Gutenberg. I'm gonna have to unplug him and work on him some more. Now I know I'm alive. Can't you see I'm alive? Robo Petey, you are not alive. Now let me just unplug your... I heard the devil whisper in my... He made his message clear when he said, sweep the leg. Hey, Robo Petey, cut it out, dude. You're not programmed for fighting anyway. And even if you were, you're not fast enough to catch me. Turbo boost and we'll see who's the fastest. Damn, he's fast. Well, it's not like he's very strong. I keep telling myself, come on, be strong. Hey, you can't just do that. Oh, wait. I forgot he could download more RAM from the internet. Somebody help me! Survival of the fittest. Survival of the smart. What's wrong, Michael? Robo Petey, please! Don't kill me, man. Come on! Can't just press undo. Oh, hey, are you the real Pete Mitchell? Oh, thanks for saving me, man. Hey, do you, you want to do the interview for real?
Yeah, I guess so. I'm sorry that that robot PD didn't work. I send those ahead of me to do interviews, but sorry about that one. Yeah, I'll do this one for real.
Okay, yeah, we'll just, maybe we'll shove him over in the corner and we'll just do this for you. Here, let me get my mic plugged in and we're ready to go. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of Michael's Mixdown. Michael's Mixdown is a show primarily about the recording arts, so whether you heard it in the studio or in the stadium, you can hear about it here on Michael's Mixdown. Today, I am living out I would say like a childhood dream, but like a college-age dream, if that's a phrase, I've got one of my musical heroes from, especially in my college days, but all through college to now, Pete Mitchell of No More Kings. And Pete is the primary kind of songwriter and guy behind the band. And I am so excited to have you on the show with me, man. How are you doing?
Great, man. Thank you so much for having me, Michael.
Yeah, this is awesome. And we're going to have a great time. I've got some cool questions lined up. And one thing that I kind of like to do is try to start sort of at the beginning. So a little later, we might talk about some time travel since you have an EP about that coming out. But take me back in time to where No More Kings really started. Like, I got the idea that there was some kind of iteration of the band before the first self-titled album came out. So how did you get like from that to the first album?
So probably about 10 years before that album came out, my writing partner Neil and I would play at like local coffee houses in Rhode Island, and we played at my college, Providence College, that I went to, and we did a couple college shows around the area, different New England colleges, and we just were this duo, this little like acoustic duo, and at the time we were just called Neil and Pete. Then we realized that we wanted to add drums, and so we met this percussionist, Chris Montecalvo, and added him. And so the three of us were like, well, we can't be Neil and Pete anymore because we've got this third guy. We called ourselves No More Kings, based on the Schoolhouse Rock episode from when we were younger. And we just, you know, we played a bunch of shows as the three of us. And then at one point, you know, we kind of went our separate ways, I moved to LA. I was kind of confused. I'm sorry, I'm getting a little ahead of myself.
Right.
Just, you know, No More Kings kind of stopped making music as No More Kings. And then years later, Neil's brother, Adam, had started a record label, and he had played bass with No More Kings every once in a while. You know, it was never like an official thing, but we had different friends of mine come on and play stuff. Mm-hmm. So he said, you know, I want to sign No More Kings for real. We never had a chance to do a proper album back then, back in the college days. So, you know, let's do it. And so that was kind of the birth of the No More Kings that everybody knows. But yeah, we played together as No More Kings probably for like, you know, 8 or 10 years prior to that.
Right. And then, so that first album, remind me the release date, that was like 2006?
Six, I think, yeah. 2006.
Okay, yeah. Actually, probably wouldn't be a bad idea to pull that up and have that have that ready to go in case I wanted to mention a specific year. But yeah, so that, in that first album, see, Spotify has it as 2007, but you're the man. Spotify can't tell us what to do.
was Spotify even a thing back then?
You know, I don't think it was.
Because maybe.
Funnily enough, like when I discovered your music, which was a couple of years after 2007, but it's funny, you never know how your music is going to like reach people and everything and how they're going to find it. But like I was watching it on YouTube, and I don't know if that entire first album had like links on YouTube. Or if it did, I didn't find them. But, like, I never heard the entire first album until, like, years later.
Oh, wow.
Because I would pull them up on, like, YouTube. And back then, you could, like, preload videos and, like, kind of even if
like you're a playlist.
Yeah. And even if your internet went out or whatever, they were just loaded and you could keep watching them. And they've taken that away since. But, like, I used to pull up a bunch of songs. And that first No More Kings album, I had, like, six of the songs or whatever pulled up and would just had them played them off of like YouTube tabs and stuff.
Oh, that's wild.
And what's really funny is like, is that at the end of Girl in the Sea that it leads into Leaving Lilliput with the little Lilliputians. I had no idea what that was for years. Like, yeah. I just thought that was something funny you left at the end of the track or something. But I hadn't heard Leaving Lilliput until like years later. So I was really confused what that was, but I thought, hey, whatever. There was something at the end of Zombie Me where people were, you know, kind of laughing. So I thought, well, maybe it's just something like that.
So when we made that album, Neil and I love, you know, listening to albums in their entirety. You know, yeah. We're still from that generation where you put an album on and listen to the whole album. And so we wanted that kind of an experience too. And now I'm realizing these days that, yeah, what you experienced as a listener is more accurate. You're going to find singles kind of out of context and listen mm-hmm. to those. But it's, you know, you're not likely to listen to the whole album in one sitting. So yeah, we don't do that now where the songs connect. But in that first album, we really wanted to make sure that everything flowed and things connected. There's a like a really warm, long fade between Umbrella, I think, and This mm-hmm. on that album. And same thing, like out of context, if you just pick one of those songs, it's going to have a really weird ending.
Right, right. But I mean, I really appreciate that kind of, I guess, album building that doesn't happen much anymore, because I'm one of the few of, you know, these days that will listen to an album. But like I said, back then Spotify either wasn't a thing or it was already had like a premium thing and I wasn't going to pay for it because I was a Poe College kid. But, but yeah, I remembered, at one point my friend Mike had the CD, and then, that was probably 20, maybe 11 or 12 or something like that. So it was a few years like later, and it was kind of halfway through college at that point. And then I think that was the first time I heard it all the way through.
So you hadn't heard like half of those songs.
Yeah. Yeah. Basically.
That's cool. Discovering all these new songs.
Right.
I died last night. Tripped over my own shoelaces. I broke my spine, fell on the sidewalk, and I landed on my face, and I thought, what a way to go.
So, speaking of the first self-titled album, the first song on that, Zombie Me, I don't know, would you explain, like, did you guys think that that was going to be kind of the bigger one, or did you think it was Sweep the Leg from the get-go?
We definitely did not think it was Sweep the Leg. Sweep the Leg is actually one of my least favorite songs on that album, which made it weird to play shows because that was our like encore, if you can say. And I was just like, you know what I mean? Like there's better songs on this album. But I like Suit the Leg. I'm just saying that wasn't
that
wouldn't have been my choice for a single. I don't know if we thought it was Zombie Me. I don't know that we thought that way. I think we were, you know, that's like something the label came to us with, like, mm-hmm. Hey, what, you know, we need a single. There's a joke about that actually with the second album, because we wrote Critical Hit as a joke way of saying like, oh, we'll give you a hit.
Right.
But on this first album, yeah, I don't think we thought about it. Zombie Me was the first one. Zombie Me and Someday were the first two songs that we recorded. And we did those as sort of a proof of concept to the label. Because like I said, Adam signed us, but he hadn't, you know, we hadn't recorded anything professionally ever before that as No More Kings. We had only ever played these live shows and most of them were acoustic. And so it was kind of a, well, can we even do this? Can we do a full album worth of like pop rock songs that like still have energy and still feel good? Mm-hmm. So Zombie Me and Someday were just sort of like, hey, this is what it could sound like. Sweep the Leg and Michael and that whole batch came later once we decided we were going to do a full album.
Gotcha. So can you explain some of the, like near the beginning of Zombie Me, there's kind of like a sampled, I don't know the exact, or it's like a sampling keyboard or something like that, where like Neil took a sample of you singing a note and then like played it. And then it's kind of that like do, and then it's, but of course there's chords and things that I can't do with just my voice, but.
Well, that's cool, exactly why he did it. Cause we couldn't do it with just, I mean, I could have sang that a cappella or whatever, but there's something really fun about Neil being able to play exactly the chords he wanted, play exactly the rhythm he wanted, but it still had that do, you know, still my singing voice.
Right.
Yeah. That's all it was. He basically sat me in front of Pro Tools with a microphone and just made me sing a bunch of notes straight just to get the whole keyboard sampled. Mm-hmm. And then just played the keyboard of me. I don't know if he still has that as an instrument. I bet he could throw that up into other songs if he wanted to.
Yeah, that would be fun. And then the zombie chorus, like the choice to leave the group kind of cracking up in at the end. And if I heard it right, that take is the one in the middle of the song, and it's like it kind of gets cut right as people are just starting to crack. And like, so how hard was that to get recorded? Because it seemed like if I had been in there, I wouldn't have been able to keep a straight face.
Just do another one.
It was, I think we do have video footage of that, but it was the most fun. That was the most fun. That and Girl in the Sea were the most fun to record in the studio with a group, because you write these songs, you know, I write these songs by myself or with Neil. So it's either me or just the two of us. And so it's isolated and it's very like a personal kind of thing. And then you go into the studio and you've got all these technicians and the sound engineer, and then you've got the musicians, and you've got, you know, like their helpers to, like, you know, the drum techs and stuff. So anyway, there's just a bunch of people.
Right.
And so it becomes a much bigger process. And so for us to, like, both with Girl in the Sea and with Zombie Me, I think those are the only two songs we kind of involved everybody. It's so much fun to bring everybody in, people that are normally like sitting at a desk or behind a mixing board. Now they got to go out there and like make zombie noises.
Right.
So I think a lot of the laughing was just being like, oh my God, this is crazy. Like, we have all these people in here making like, you know, like,
right.
So yeah, you're right. I don't think we made it through a single take without laughing, but we did probably like 20 takes of it. So I think the one that we used was probably just our last one, where we were just like, we couldn't do any more, you know?
Right. And that reminds me of a funny story. When I was in college, one of my first big recording projects with a full band, they had a song where they had this idea for everybody to shout, like a big kind of stadium of people shouting, that kind of thing. And so we all of us engineer, like students, got and went into the studio with these guys. And I was the only one that apparently didn't catch that there were only like three yeahs. And I went for a fourth yeah, and everybody just fell over.
Because it's just this one person. I said, yeah.
And then, of course, like, that was also my first experience trying to mix, like, four people and trying to make them sound like, you know, 1,000 people. And so that was...
Oh, wow.
That was fun. But, and then, so... When you played that song live, I also got the idea that you could kind of tell who was a fan and who had just showed up because of the call and response.
And all the zombies in the house say, oh. And all the zombies in the house say, hey, hey, oh.
It was like a secret handshake. That was maybe my favorite thing about playing shows live. When it came time for Zombie Me, that was the litmus test. That was the way of finding out, like, ah, do you already know about us or are you a brand new person?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, you could, like, half the audience would go, oh, you know, because they wouldn't know any better. And the right. other half would do the zombie noises. And I on stage, I don't know why, like, that cracked me up every single time. Just the fact that people knew it and then did it and were, like, excited to be a zombie in that moment.
Right.
I actually wish that I had done more stuff like that in other songs without being gimmicky. But there was something so, like I said, that made me smile every single time. That was the one thing that, as old as Sweep the Leg got, Zombie Me always felt fresh for that reason.
I didn't see it coming, creeping up from behind. I was almost swallowed whole by the thrill of the fight. It wasn't for the money.
So, speaking of Sweep the Leg, I've always been curious how that guitar solo was done, because it's all chopped up, kind of like somebody's hitting the kill switch on a guitar. But, like, at the same time, I know that you couldn't play that fast and hit the kill switch at the same time, probably, unless somebody was helping you out. So, do you remember if that was done, like, digitally after the fact, or...
Oh, Neil plays it live that way.
Really?
It's similar to what you're saying, but there's, like, it's like a tremolo. It's like a type of a tremolo effect that does dip down to nothing.
Okay.
So he's not, like, stopping it, but yeah, I don't remember exactly how he's doing it, but he's doing that. Yeah. He's doing that live. Mm. He could have chopped it up in Pro Tools. That would have been certainly easier.
Right.
But I think he liked the idea that this is something that he could play live.
Right. I imagine there's, like, pedals that can do that.
Yeah, I don't remember if he didn't custom build a pedal, but I think he custom made, like, some kind of patch for that.
But yeah, I would just always thought that was really cool, and I couldn't tell if somebody, if there was, like, ever, like, a full version of that guitar solo and then somebody had just chopped it up, or if it was kind of recorded that way. But
yeah, it was intended to be that way. That's it was cool. Fun because we had you know, when, so we wrote the first album together, Neil and I, and then Neil had a band with his wife called Dirt Poor Robins. Those guys are incredible if you don't know them already. But he wasn't ever going to be in No More Kings officially. Mm-hmm. He was just going to produce and write and co-write with me. So No More Kings on paper was just me. So when it came time to play live shows after the full album was recorded, we held auditions in Nashville, and we hired, like, a bunch of cats to form out the full No More Kings band. So that, getting a guitarist who could do that, who could play that solo the way it was on the album live, you know, because you're not going to be able to, you know what I mean, was tricky. I think that was one of the hardest parts, honestly, was finding a guitarist that could play Neil's parts, because Neil's a virtuoso, in my opinion.
Right. Yeah, damn good. And of course, so the music video that followed that up with the whole cast and crew of The Karate Kid. And I was wondering, do you feel like maybe 1% or, you know, 0.5% responsible for, like, Cobra Kai? Because I feel like that was the first time that probably all those people had gotten back together in a room in a number of years. And so I figured that maybe they started talking, like, hey, this was kind of fun. Maybe we should try to do this. And
so it turns out that Billy had ideas about that before he ever met me. Billy Zabka, the guy that plays Johnny in the original Karate Kid. He he felt the same way I did. He felt like there was more to tell about that story. And so he never, I don't know if he had anything official going, but he definitely was like thinking of like, how can we do this? You know? And clearly when that video came out, the impact, or not the impact, what am I trying to say? Like how many people came out of the woodwork that were like Karate Kid fans, you know, and it made me realize what a humongous audience that movie had that hadn't had any new content from that movie in you know, 20 years, 30 years. So my point is, I think there were a lot of people who already wanted more, were already thinking about more. I think all I did was kind of shine a light on it. So I think the guys that came up with Cobra Kai, I don't know that they were influenced by Sweep the Leg. I just think that Sweep the Leg kind of said, hey, look, this is possible. You know, like people still want to hear more about this story.
Right. Yeah, there's still a lot of interest in that franchise. And
exactly. That's exactly right.
And then, of course, one of these days I would die if I ever heard Sweep the Leg on like the end credits or something for Cobra Kai.
I've always been like, why? Yeah, why don't you just throw it in there? Let's be so easy.
Right.
My favorite thing would be as if they had like, you know how like it was either season one or season two where Johnny had you know, they did that demonstration live at one of the festivals or whatever, and he had you know, the big boombox playing, whatever. I thought how much fun it would be if he had Sweep the Leg on that, or if he hired No More Kings to come and play, like to pump him up, like the Cobra Kai pump up song. You know what I mean?
Right.
Which doesn't make sense now since the schools are. But anyway, yeah, I always thought that'd be fun. I would have loved to have been involved in any official way.
Right.
But I guess this didn't work out that way.
Well, maybe one day.
There's still time.
Yeah, there's still some time. We'll see. So, of course, my name is Michael, and the show's called Michael's Mixdown. So I'm going to have to just give myself a free edit to insert Michael, jump in, just, you know, right here would be good.
Here comes Michael. He's got that look like he's in too deep. That's just like him. Truth be told, he needs a good night's sleep. He's not in the mood for metaphor. Open up the car door and just turn the radio on. So long, Michael. It was nice to see you too. We see it all the time, so keep it coming. But our necks are on the line, and that's not funny. Jump in, let's save the world. Pick up your shoes and put on your sunglasses. Jump in, let's save the world. Turbo boost and we'll see who's the fastest. Jump in, let's save the world. Let's save the world.
Sometimes it's hard to find a place to like cut away and do an insert, and so because it's like sometimes like the conversations just flow, and it's like, well, I don't want to stop it and put in a song right here. So it's like sometimes it's hard to find a place to cut it, and then where it feels like, you know, here's the song, here's the example, whatever, and then come back to whatever we were talking about before. But my question is when you write a song that's like packed full of references, like Alone in Graceland or Michael Jump In or Sweep the Leg, do you do like a deep dive of that content, or do you just kind of have a lot of those references like floating around in your head already ready to go?
Yeah. And in fact, it's come up to bite me in the butt. I usually write from memory because I'm writing about things that I loved and they were hugely important to me. So Karate Kid is one of my favorite movies growing up. Knight Rider is one of my favorite shows. You know, so those I wrote just from memory. And it turns out sometimes I get stuff wrong, actually, and it's stuck in the song forever. And I wish I had done a little research, or I wish I had like hired someone to spot check that stuff for me. Like, for example, in Sweep the Leg, I say King of 1985, but it was 1984 when they made that movie. I justify it by saying I think it didn't come out, or it wasn't popular till 85.
Right.
But the truth is I just remembered it wrong. So there's things like that, you know, with the Short Circuit song, Robots Don't Cry, like all those. I should have probably researched them a little bit better and did a deep dive, but I wrote them because I was kind of, you know, feeling nostalgic about that, or like moved to write about that. In the case of Michael Jump In, I love that show so much. But one of the things I think was interesting about the show is Michael Knight didn't want to be a hero. He had no desire. He's sort of an, you know, anti-hero in the sense that he just, and like literally in the show, I feel like the car has to convince him to be the hero, you know, like, so I always thought that was a fun angle, you know, instead of writing it from the perspective of Michael, I wanted to write it from the perspective of the car who has to convince him, you know, tell him like, no, man, you were born to be a hero.
Right. Actually, I have a friend that has a kit car. It's not, I think the original was Corvette, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
And I think his is a Firebird, but it definitely does have like the little light up thing in the front.
With the light on the front. Yeah. Oh my gosh. I love that.
So I don't think he's had it out or done anything with it for a while, but it's definitely a fun car.
That's so cool. I'm not invited. Feel like Darth Vader with this helmet on my head. I can't see. I'm in there somewhere past the plastic shield. When will I find me? Someday I'll know. If I left beyond my own, how far would I go? Someday I'll know. Someday I'll know.
So then I have a really special soft spot in my heart for Someday, because I feel like that is kind of an anthem for like every repressed nerd that ever was or a performer or somebody that wanted to dance or sing but was like maybe too I don't know what the best word choice for it would be, but somebody that's like a little bit repressed, maybe from like an outside source or like a parent or something that is kind of telling them like, no, you need to be normal and not do that. Cause like growing up, my family used to constantly tease me for my like kind of nerdy and quirky interests.
Oh, no.
And you know, like as an adult, I'm trying to be like, okay, so, you know, I know it was all in good fun. They were trying to be funny and like they all poked fun at one another. But like at the same time, I'm like, why did you have to pick on me so much for liking like Pokemon and stuff like when I was growing up?
Totally.
And then I didn't want to talk about that stuff. Like I felt really repressed and quiet. And so I would sit in the back seat of like cars on like road trips and play my little Game Boy. And I wouldn't say anything for hours because I'd be like, oh, if I say something about my Bulbasaur, like they're just going to make fun of me or whatever. What did you have like a similar experience or growing up? Because I think that regardless that every, you know, young kind of nerdy or creative type should hear this song because it has such a good message. But I wondered if that came from somewhere more personal for you.
Absolutely. So I was really lucky in the sense that my parents didn't. Like my mom bought me Dungeons and Dragons, and she was like the first dungeon master for me. Nice. until we got into it. Yeah. And at a time where, you know, nobody was playing that game. Everybody was making fun of it or thinking it was like demonic or something.
Yeah, but, Satanic Panic.
You remember that? Yeah. So I didn't get it from home, but I absolutely got it at school because I was into all that stuff. Neil and I, our first like, it's fun. Neil was funny because he was like super popular guy in school, but then he came and hung out with me and we wrote songs about my dog or we ran around with my camcorder and made kung fu movies in my backyard. Like, yep. So I think he was a closet nerd.
Yeah.
And just didn't let anybody know. And I was just unabashed nerd, you know?
Right.
So yeah, I wrote that song for exactly that reason. I was kind of just thinking about that in myself, you know, having that nostalgia of like remembering my childhood and remembering how important it was for me to not listen to bullies and society and not listen to the people who are trying to dress me up, but rather I want, you know, what do I want to say? What do I want to be, you know?
Right.
So that I wrote that with that in mind, making it kind of an anthem for that part of us. So it's funny that you're talking about this, and that makes me sad to hear your story because I feel like you're right. A lot of people probably got that. And we have this like society, I think it's finally starting to go away, but for a long time we had this society sense of you get made fun of for liking something. If you're mm-hmm. passionate about something, people are going to make fun of you. And that's so ridiculous to me because those people, the people that are passionate, me, you, like the people that are passionate about something are the people that go out and do amazing things. They do amazing, creative, fun things. They make the world around us beautiful and interesting and more worth being in. And the people that would sit there and make fun of that and then contribute nothing You know,
right.
I don't know. I never understood that. I never understood that mentality or how it's like not cool to be good at something or to like something. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I feel like we're moving past that now. Like when I walk into Barnes & Noble and I see that there's Dungeons & Dragons books everywhere, mm-hmm. my little nerd heart just goes pitter patter because I'm right. like, it's not bad to like this stuff anymore. It's cool to like this stuff.
Right. And see, like in a similar sense, like I already have, you know, people in my life that are saying, okay, the Marvel movies and all that stuff is played out. I'm tired of, but I'm like, I'm here for it as long as it's going to be here because like I grew up
Absolutely.
Getting like relentlessly bullied for liking comic books and,
yeah, me
and
too.
Stuff like that. And now it's like, these are the big number one hit movies of today and everybody, you're kind of almost a dork if you don't know it. So yep. like, I'm here for it. Oh,
I agree.
And all the like I have a board game collection and I have a lot of like Marvel licensed kind of games. And my one friend will pick on me like you only have like three games because you have 800 Marvel games that are all the same. I was like, dude, you know what? When I was a kid, I would have killed for
there weren't any of these.
Like, yeah. So like the stuff that I was interested in didn't get made into video games or board games or anything like that. Like, you know, if you wanted to play a board game when I was eight, it was like Monopoly. Like there wasn't a whole lot going on.
Absolutely. No, that's why this is so exciting for those reasons that you just said. The fact that Dungeons and Dragons is popular and not mm-hmm. like a nerd thing. Comic books are so cool that they make movies like with A-list actors and it's a huge thing. And then board games are a huge industry now. I think a big part of what's cool about all this is like YouTube. So yep. YouTube has made it where you can connect with people who like your same thing mm-hmm. that don't necessarily live in your area. Cause like when I was a kid, if I didn't have friends that played board games or did read comic books or wanted to make movies, you know, I couldn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
But now you can find your tribe.
Yeah.
Online.
Or you like Discord and Twitch and stuff like that too, because you'll find
people playing
the game that you're interested in. You can kind of connect to them.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that. It's really exciting.
Yep. That was my child. I would have killed as a kid to get what I have today. So like, I'm not letting it go now. So like,
I totally agree with that. Yeah. Keep making that stuff. I'll keep watching it.
Right. Okay. So back to some No More Kings content. Girl in the Sea looks like it had a lot of Foley work that went into it. And you mentioned earlier about that there was a lot of fun getting people out and recording that. So can you talk a little bit about like how much work went into the sound effects and the Foley work and stuff? And there's a video on YouTube that anybody can go and find on your YouTube that looked like you guys were out with like brooms and stuff. And
yeah.
I don't know if you were
hitting each other on the butt. Yeah.
Swabbing the deck and hitting each other in the butt and stuff. So I would just be interested to hear a little bit more about how that all came together.
Back at the harbor, still I am swimming with her in my mind. In my David Jones locker, I'll keep my secret where no one can find it. Oh, they'd never believe me. Oh, I see her so clearly. All the legends of old, the stories they told, the schemes
of... So that one, similar to Zombie Me, was another one of those where we were like, well, we need everybody. We need all hands on deck, literally, in this mm-hmm. one. And so we just had everybody, all the assistants, you know, anybody come out there and stomp and clap and, hey, you know, make pirate noises. And yeah, Neil ran around with whatever he had, like brooms, like dustpans, like whatever would make a, you know, kind of noise. Because mm-hmm. we wanted everything to be not diegetic necessarily, but like we wanted it to feel like these are sounds that came from the actual pirate ship. We wanted it to feel like these guys, these sailors or pirates are singing this sea chanty,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you know what I mean? And the best way to do that was to have us all as a group actually run around and do it. Stomp our, you know, rooms on the ground. So you get that, you know, kind of noise.
Right.
Yeah. So that was kind of it. So basically we all stood in a big clump And then Neil just kind of directed us, you know, to like stop on beat, do all this stuff. Hey, you know, and then he ran around separately with a broom and just hit it on everything, scraped it across the brick walls, hit it on people's butts and pants. And because something about like the denim sound mixed with the bristles made like a, you know, just a cool, I don't know.
Right. Just
gathering raw material basically that we could sprinkle throughout that section of the song. And then, so my other favorite thing about that, there's this tap dance solo after the violin solo in that song. So we don't know anybody that could tap dance, or we didn't back then. So Neil went and bought tap dance shoes and put them on his hands and just played it like like drums, you know?
Nice. That's awesome. Yeah, I mean, based on the video, and it just looked like you guys were having a blast. And I love when I'm working in a studio and anything like that. Like, I love the possibilities in a studio where somebody will just say, hey, like, we need to do this. And then all of a sudden, everybody's, like, creative brain is just, like, firing on all cylinders and that kind of thing. It's a good feeling.
Absolutely. Well, it's weird because you probably know this. Like, studio stuff, studio time can be dry. It can be, it's very repetitive. You're doing the same, either you're singing the same take 13 times, you're playing the same guitar part, same, you know, so it can be very dry and very repetitive. And for me, this was my first experience recording in a professional studio that back then. That was my first time ever being in a studio, ever being in front of a, you know, expensive mic like that, you know. The first time recording anything that wasn't on a laptop, basically.
Right.
And so to have all these great, like really, just really good at their job people, but also that spirit of playfulness and fun. Because again, we're singing about zombies and mermaids and talking cars. Like, we're not doing the typical angsty rock album.
Right.
So it's kind of impossible to record that music without, you know, being a little playful.
Right. Right. And I think that really comes through in the track too, because it's at least in me, I can't speak for everybody, but it inspires a lot of joy and laughter. So, now I'm gonna ask a very nerdy recording question about God Breathed. the snare sound choice in that song always intrigued me, and it stuck out in a good way to me because it's a very ringy snare.
Adam sat all alone giving names to squirrels. Hey. Self-obsessed, so depressed in his own little world. All in all, he's got nothing to lose but solitude. God breathed, God breathed on Adam.
The very first lesson I ever got as a recording engineer was like, you have to do everything you can to eliminate any kind of ring and a snare. And that was basically just like, that was the standard. They were like, no, you can't like record a ringy snare. Everybody
hates it. It's
gotta
be crisp. And
yeah.
Yeah.
And so that song really works with that snare choice. Maybe was the first time I'd ever heard a snare that didn't just sound kind of like every other snare from every other kind of like rock album that I'd ever heard. So was there, I don't know, ever much kind of discussion about like, or did somebody just say that, oh, that's, I'm going to do this because that's the way this song feels? Or
I wish I remembered that better. I'm pretty sure it was our mixing engineer, Craig Alvin. You know, the part is like, boom, boom. You know, it's very like,
yeah,
stadium rock stomp kind of stomp clap kind of vibe, right? So we needed the snare, the to like, I guess when you're doing that, you have a choice. You can either put reverb on it, you can, you know, double it. You could, there's a couple things you can do to make that sound different than a just, you know, a normal snap snare.
Right.
And so I don't remember if it was Neil that had the idea or if it was Craig, but I think, yeah, I think he just was like, you know, experimenting with different, I think he went through a bunch of different options to try to make it pop differently,
right,
than the rest of the kit.
Right. And I mean, I think it serves the song really well, which is what, there's some musicians out there and some engineer people that, I don't know, like playing really fast and really technical and stuff is always fun and impressive, but, there's some of us that are a little more minded towards like what actually serves the song. And I think that opens up creative avenues because you can find things that serve this particular song, but maybe not the next the song before it. So
absolutely. No, I love that you said that. Cause I think that's the thing. Like, you know, people give Ringo Starr a lot of crap for not being this incredible drummer, but he mm-hmm. was probably one of the best rock drummers because of that, because he was tasteful.
Yeah.
He played what the song needed. He wasn't trying to be flashy or show off. And so his choices were really right. And I feel like the best, that's what's cool about like a band like No More Kings. We're not Maroon 5. We're not trying to be sexy. We're not trying mm-hmm. to be like, you know, rock star. So we could get away with all kinds of creative choices in the sound of the music. I mean, Knickerbocker, like who mm-hmm. would do a, you know, a song like that? Or, do you know what I mean? Like, or even Girl in the Sea on the first album, like to go from Sweep the Leg, with this, you know, and then suddenly you do this like waltz, like mm-hmm. a pirate ship waltz. Like, yeah. So I think, I suppose that was one of my favorite things about having that freedom. And not feeling like we had to have radio hits.
Right.
We could just play. We could just be playful and we could make a choice about having a snare ring out that all the audio nerds would be like, oh, you can't do that. You know, but yeah, we can because it sounds cool.
Right. So that, I think, kind of ties together with this other question really nicely because a lot of the No More King stuff contains, you know, references and humor to, you know, pop culture and 80s stuff and zombies and all kinds of other things. But like, you know, a couple of times on an album, it seems like we get like a Girl in the Sea or a This or a Someday Umbrella or a Tracy's song where it's it feels a little more intimate and kind of sort of like a foil to those other kind of songs. And I was just wondering, how does the process of writing those songs, like that are a little more tender, kind of, you know, work as opposed to the more funny songs with like cool 80s references and stuff? Because, like we were just saying, like there's creative avenues that you don't have to make every song sound like the last one. And it doesn't have to sound like the song that comes after it. And like the stuff from the drum kit can be different. And I think that makes your album so easy to listen to over and over again because they're not so homogenous, if that makes sense. And I think it keeps me more engaged and want to listen to it again because it's like, it goes up and down and there's energy in it. And it's not just kind of the same thing where you have to try to write 10 hits over and over again.
Exactly. Yeah, I think there's a lot of reasons for that, but I think the main thing is we were a band in or right around college and just after college, and then we didn't play live anymore. Mm-hmm. We didn't play music and we didn't write songs, and then I got signed, and so we wrote this full album. Some of the songs were from our early days that we kind of tweaked and made sound a little more modern because they were 10 years old at that point. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the half the songs we wrote brand new. And so when writing those songs, a lot of it was me just thinking about like, you know, what things moved me as a kid, what, you know, what things were, I don't know why I got in that mode of like basing things on childhood and nostalgia, but sometimes those were a song like Someday that isn't about show. It's about me. Mm-hmm. Or Umbrella, same thing. That isn't really it. There's some references to, you know, Gene Kelly and things like that mm-hmm. in there, but the song isn't about that. It's about my philosophy on that, you know? And mm-hmm. so, or this is another great example of it's not based on anything. It's just a, you know, so balancing that was always tricky because I didn't want to do a whole album of that stuff that was just very introspective and personal and like, hey, this is me growing up or the things that I've learned over life. But I also didn't want to do a full album of like, what I was afraid of at the time would be considered novelty songs. I'm realizing now that they're not novelty songs,
right.
But I was afraid of that, you know? So I deliberately wanted to balance both of those things. What I was going to say is because we wrote the album, we wrote it to be recorded. I think most times bands are out touring, playing consistently, and they're sharing stuff that's in progress. And when it comes time to record an album, they're just picking the 10 best songs that they've been playing. Mm-hmm. And so it's these songs that have been, right? Like, so for No More Kings, there's no B-sides. There's no extra stuff because we wrote everything specifically to be on the album. And so we have a sense, right? So Neil and I have a sense of the landscape of the album, how it's going to go. So to your point about some songs are energetic and rock, and then some songs are a little bit more subtle and ballad. And you know, mm-hmm. that is because we had a chance to craft that landscape. I like to think of albums as a movie. I like to make sure that there's a chase scene, there's a love scene, mm-hmm. there's dialogue scenes, there's drama. You know, there's the big finale. Like I want to make sure that all the scenes are present in it. So again, I don't think I could have done that if we were picking our best songs from the past 2 years of touring and trying to throw them on an album.
Right.
I think I only got to do that because I was essentially a recording artist first.
Yeah. Well, and then speaking of like the landscape of the album, I wondered if you, was there a lot of thought that went into like the track order and how to make it kind of flow like the landscape that you're talking about? Because it seemed like it was.
Yeah, so that took a long time. That took almost as long as writing the album. We have so many different versions of the CD that we press and then listen to in our car, just kind of sit with for a couple days,
mm-hmm.
And just see how one song flowed into another and making sure there was enough time between songs before your brain, you know, could let go of the previous song and be ready for the new one. And
right.
All that stuff, all those decisions were just tested them and tried them and tried them until we got what we liked.
Right. So another type of song that kind of stands out to me from No More Kings is kind of like the Paper Airplane, Old Man Walking, and the Mr. B. Like, those kind of songs strike me as so interesting because I don't think like I'd ever heard a song about like a personified paper airplane before. Just wondering, like, you know, if some people like might consider those kind of things like mundane, or like if you put like a paper airplane in front of somebody and said write a song, like I think most people probably would not be very inspired by that. But so I was wondering how you got inspiration out of stuff like that and made them into really cool jams.
Right. Well, that one's a bit tricky. I'll get to that in a second.
Okay.
But I will say that I've always loved personifying things. I always love finding ways of making something a metaphor for how I feel about something. And so looking at objects and giving them voices, or, you know, I had a whole show I did where we would improv these little objects talking to each other, and then I would animate faces on them later. Mm-hmm. So I've always been interested in, you know, bringing things to life that way. With Paper Airplane, though, so this was actually a kind of a conversation that happened with Neil and I never meant that to literally be about a paper airplane. That was just about me. I was just saying, like, I feel like a paper airplane. I feel like I'm just floating through this life, going wherever the wind takes me. And I want to drive. I want to be in control a little bit. And so it was that the song was about me being like, you know, making that transition from, I'm fine. I've had a great life. I'm happy with where the wind has taken me. I've always seen some great things and landed on some great things, but I think it's time for me to be the pilot, you know?
Right.
I'm a paper airplane, got my wings stretched out, and I'm dipping in the snow.
And when I presented the song to Neil and the opening line, I'm a paper airplane, Neil felt the way that you did. He was like, oh, you're literally singing a song about a paper airplane. He's like, you can't just say that. And I was like, no, had a hard time. And I think any other band wouldn't have had that problem because they don't normally write those kinds of songs. Mm-hmm. But because all my songs are about a character who's not me, I think it, you know what I mean? It set the stage for like, oh, well, now he's writing literally about a paper airplane.
Gotcha.
So that was a tricky one because I didn't intend that.
Right. And that kind of reminds me, you had a background in animation too, like,
yeah.
And so you, I can see that now, I guess, putting the pieces together that you would kind of have that animation kind of influence your songwriting a little bit, trying to bring characters to life and stuff.
Absolutely.
Like that.
When I moved to LA from Rhode Island, one of my earliest jobs was working for the Walt Disney Company. And I was working on video games and, you know, making stuff with their characters. And then right after that, I got a job working for the Jim Henson Company, working on Muppet properties. And so those two jobs alone really strengthened my desire to tell stories about characters, you mm-hmm. know, and really be like character driven. So when it came time to write songs, instead of writing angsty love songs, I knew that I wanted to write songs about characters. I wanted to tell stories with songs.
That's awesome.
Thanks, man.
I feel like I have a new perspective for this. I'll have to go listen to it again. And also, right, I love the horn section too.
Oh, my favorite.
There's a horn section in a lot of songs, actually.
Yeah, Robots Don't Cry has a great horn section. Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wish more, especially more like rock and stuff, would have horn sections or just include more brass. But
again, I feel like that's because we were writing an album first. We weren't thinking about what we had to do live.
Yeah.
And so Neil was like, well, let's get a 6-part horn section for this song.
Yeah.
Whereas a band usually is like, well, we have these 5 players.
Mm-hmm.
What can we do with these 5 players, you know?
Right, right.
Not always, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, right. So one of my favorite songs is this.
Ask the man what he wanted most. I guess he wanted most of all to know. And then he asked me what I wanted.
I've always wondered, I guess, if from different people's perspective, like what their this would be.
Right.
And mine, pretty consistently throughout my life, if I stop and think about, like, you know, what I want most is this, is I'm just sitting, like, with my dogs. Or,
yes.
Like, sometimes, oh, like, you know, sometimes I just, like, I sit here in this house and I think about, like, you know, I own a little chunk of land and I've got my dogs and my fenced in yard. And I kind of think, like, this is it. Like, this is what I wanted. And so, like,
I love that, Michael. I love that. It's really cool.
You know, and like, and sometimes I just feel like we're sitting through life and you just, it kind of hits me. Like, if I had to reflect on this moment 20 years from now and somebody said, like, what, you know, what do you want most? And I think, you know, this, like what I'm sitting here right now, like,
Oh, you nailed it.
And I don't know, like, sometimes it's, you know, sometimes it's like my dogs, but sometimes it's like people that I miss, like my dad or my brother. Like, I think back to memories of like them having their arm around me or whatever. And I'm like, what do I want most is this, like,
yeah,
sometimes
that moment.
It's stuff that I can't get back anymore and that kind of thing. But I was wondering if you had like a specific this in mind or if your this changes kind of like mine does.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's a great way to say it. I think it changes as you grow. So when I wrote the song initially, this just meant that conversation. That was based on a real conversation I had with one of my best friends growing up, Brendan. And you know, I've always been an artist and I've always was doing all this stuff. And we got into this conversation about like, why do you do all that? You know, why do you spend all this time? Because like, you know, there's times when you're making an art project that it's not fun, you know? And he was like, why do you do this if it's not fun? And we were having kind of this, and he said, I asked him, well, what do you want, you know, out of your time here? And he was like, I don't know, you know, I guess I'm trying to find that. And when he asked me, I said this because I meant this interaction, this conversation, this moment, like having this conversation with, you know, at the time, my best friend and figuring this out. But yeah, that's definitely changed over time. But I think it still means a similar idea to me. It still means exactly what you said, that presence, that in that moment, being with your dog, being with your brother, being with your father, like sitting in your house that you own on the land that you, like, it means that. It just means like, forget all the other stuff. Forget all this. Just it's this moment. It's right. This presence. It's like, how lucky am I right now to be alive and to have the life that I've had, have the people that love me, that I love. Like,
exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like I said, I think that's why that song means so much to me. Cause it's multifaceted in a way for me, because it's just this can kind of change. So
I always felt a little weird about putting that song on the album, because I felt like no one was going to relate to that. So I love hearing that story from you. I love hearing when people like connect to that song.
Yeah. Well, you, at least me, there's probably others, but at least me, you got one. So another thing that I'd always kind of wondered, in the song Critical Hit, which is a super awesome song, and we've been talking about Dungeons and Dragons, and so that also, I think, is at least on your mind these days, a Dungeons and Dragons kind of thing, maybe looking forward after the next project, right? It was kind of, I think you brought that up somewhere on Patreon, that it was at least...
Oh, yeah.
At least rattling around, maybe do a Dungeons and Dragons kind of
Yeah,
project.
I wrote another song called Half-Elf Barbarian.
Yeah.
That I want to put on a Critical Hit EP.
Right. So I hadn't played D&D when I first heard this song. So I at least now know that, you know, when you roll a 20, you get a critical hit, you do double damage. But I always wondered if 90 double damage was a specific reference to something I wasn't getting, or if it was just the word flow just... work just right.
Those lyrics are wrong. I saw that online one time and I laughed my butt off. There are so many misheard lyrics on Wikipedia for that. So it's "my main man did double damage." There's no 90 in it.
Oh, my main man.
I'm just
did
saying,
double
like,
damage.
My main man did double damage with it.
That's all. I never knew that. So
no one did. Apparently, I didn't know that was hard to understand, but apparently, people thought it was 90 double damage. And there's another part where it says, to something about an eternal life bound foe. I'm like, what is that? I didn't say that. I say, to introduce some mood, we turn the lights down low.
Yeah, I knew that, like, one.
Okay, good, good, good.
But yeah, so like, I don't know if you're aware of this, but like Spotify does...
they have the lyrics wrong,
like,
too?
Lyric. Yeah, and I'm almost certain that...
I'm going to change that if that's true.
Because it's...
Actually, I don't have control over that album.
So it's lyrics provided by Music's Match.
It's so like, just pulled those in from like a Wikipedia or something that I didn't write.
But I don't know if you can read the screen, but or if it's reversed, but it says 90 double damage.
I make 90 double. That is not what I sing.
Oh man, I never knew that. Okay, my friend, I think my friend Mike is gonna flip when he hears that. Because
when listen to the song now, it's pretty clear. I go, my main man did double damage with it.
Yeah, I'll have to listen to it again, because like all these years, I never knew that.
It's like a pump up, you know, like right. Oh, my main man, you did it, you know, like.
Well, let it be known to all fools and suckas that is what it is.
All sucka MCs.
All sucka MCs. that's awesome.
When I saw that in your question list, I was like, oh, I hope he asked me this one, because I want to clear the air on that.
Yeah.
There's a lot of songs that I find online where the lyrics are so dramatically wrong that it cracks me up.
That's funny. All right. One other thing that I had was that I'd always considered the No More Kings albums to have a very high like production value, like not necessarily that they had a lot of money dumped into them, but just that on the user end of things, like that, all those albums always sound so crisp on like a nice pair of headphones or a good set of speakers. And I just wondered if you had any ideas like what factors contributed to that kind of high fidelity sound that, because I, like I said, being a recording guy myself, that's one facet of music that I think I get something out of that not everybody else does. So like sometimes I enjoy songs not necessarily because of the content, but just because of how good they sound or how well produced they are.
I can see that. But, yeah, I can see that.
Yeah.
So I don't really have an answer other than Neil,
yeah,
he's a monster. Like he's not a perfectionist because he knows when to let go, but he does not settle. He will not settle for something that he knows he can do better. So part of that is the old adage, crap in, crap out, right? Like he makes sure that every take is, even when with recording me, like he'll just make me do take after take until he's like, I didn't get that line. Like, you know, so just on a vocal level, just making sure that he gets exactly what he wants. But then he does the same thing for himself. He will not let up. He will make sure he gets exactly the right sound going in. So that's part of it. Then the second thing is we work with like the best engineers, you know? So, you know, we went to Nashville for both of those first two albums and just, you know, made sure, and Neil sits there with the person. So he's so hands-on and he's got such a tremendous ear. So I would say, honestly, it's just Neil. Neil is just, you know, he's just a monster. He's so good. He just makes sure. And you can hear them get better. Like the first album sounds good, but the second album sounds really good, in my opinion, comparatively. I mean, if you're talking about a comparison of the songs, but just what you're saying, the technical, like, they just sound good.
Yeah. Well, thanks to Neil then.
I will pass that on.
Okay. And then like I had mentioned before, I wasn't aware of No More Kings until my friend Mike from college, who was a roommate of mine. And then we've continued to be good friends post-college. And, you know, once in a blue moon, like when we're talking, we'll still slip in like a reference to, you know, like a title of an No More Kings song or something, just to see if we can catch the other one off guard, to see if we'd forgotten or if we still know it. But so I reached out to him and I said, hey, I feel like, you know, I owe you one begrudgingly for that's me and Mike. That's always been our friendship style. But so I asked him if he had any questions for you. And he said that he is absolutely obsessed with your Bad, Bad Leroy Brown cover from, I don't know if it's on 3 or is it a single?
Both.
Both. Okay.
So what happened with that one was it was on the album, and then something happened with our distributor. We you know, and then I picked up and re-uploaded everything to Spotify. And when I did that, because it was a cover, I had trouble getting the license for it. So I had to keep it off the newest version. So yeah,
I gotcha.
It's supposed to be on the album.
I gotcha.
Well, the south side of Chicago is the baddest part of town. And if you go down there, you better just beware of a man named Leroy Brown. Now Leroy, he trouble. You see, he's standing about 6'4". And all the downtown ladies call him Treetop Love. All the men, they just call him Sir. And he's bad, bad Leroy Brown, baddest man in the whole damn.
Mike's question was I'd be interested to know on how you settled on that tempo/style of that cover, because it's, he says that how you came to decide like what kind of song you'd want to do a cover of, and then how you changed, like it's a faster tempo or a more upbeat version. And he's just kind of curious on how you, I guess maybe how that song came together and how you came to that decision to cover that one.
I love that. I love that question. So the decision to cover that particular song, No More Kings 3, album 3, was actually, it's funny, it's their third album, so that's why it's called 3. Mm-hmm. But it's also technically 3 separate projects squished together. So the first project was called Songs for the Undead, which is why there are so many zombie songs on that album. Mm-hmm. I was planning on doing a full album of zombie songs. And then the second project was a project called 1973. which I was planning on doing a full album of stuff called 1973. Basically, that's the year that Neil and I were both born. So we wanted to pick events from 1973. And that's why Tricky is on there, because that was when the Watergate scandal happened. Alone in Graceland, because that's when Elvis and Priscilla split up. Enter the Dragon, because that's the year that Bruce Lee died. You know, so we picked these songs based on the year. So one of the most popular songs from 1973 was Jim Croce's Bad Boy Leroy Brown. Mm-hmm. So that's how why we picked that. It was purely because the other choice was Kodachrome by Paul Simon.
Okay.
So we were vacillating between Kodachrome and Bad Boy Leroy Brown. We actually tried both to find out the energy. And we realized partway through Kodachrome that we couldn't really do anything different. You know, it had to be that energy, had to be that vibe. And we're like, well, that's been done already. You know, mm-hmm. I don't want to cover a song if we can't put our own spin on it or find a different way to do it. So with Bad Boy Leroy Brown, I think the original is a little slower, mm-hmm. and I think has a different kind of energy. But yeah, we really wanted to bring, just like Girl in the Sea, we wanted it to feel like a barroom brawl.
Right.
We wanted it to feel like it was actually, you know, so that kind of honky-tonk piano and, you know, live kind of energy. But in terms of the tempo and the groove and the feel, I think we just sat around with an acoustic and just riffed over and over until we came up with the vibe that we liked. I think it just took some workshopping, you know?
Right, right. And then also that song also has a great brass section going on too.
Yes. Yep,
And so what's funny is, like, here, I can show you. The band that I do live sound for is the Gabriel Harley Band. And Gabe plays trumpet, and he was talking about maybe doing a cover of Bad Bad Leroy Brown. And I was like, I happen to know a more modern day version of that that has some brass in it. And so that we've at least briefly discussed maybe sitting down to listen to that and trying to emulate what you did when they do live sets. Because they were looking for some other songs to add in for another set and mix it up some. So
that'd be great. It's a really fun song anyway. The original is obviously amazing.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And then we're getting, I think, pretty much wrapped up here. Was there anything that, like, you specifically wanted to bring up? Like, maybe something that you had a thought that, like, oh, I thought he was going to ask about that, but he didn't. Or if you just want to talk about maybe the next upcoming stuff that you kind of got oven or...
I had one question. I wanted to know. So you said your friend Mike turned you on to No More Kings. How did he find out about us? Do you know?
You know, I don't know. Mike has a very cool knack for finding a lot of bands from all over. And I assume that you and Mike could sit down and talk about, like, certain 80s movies, like, endlessly. And so he probably was just either looking up stuff about Karate Kid or something like that, or Knight Rider, and stumbled across one of your songs. But he's had a lot of great suggestions of stuff over the years to me. If I was to describe a big section of his musical taste, it was like, it's basically No More Kings and things like No More Kings, where it's a little bit serious, it's a little bit funny or a little bit humor kind of injected.
Yep.
And we share that a lot, but yeah, he consistently comes up with stuff that's kind of similar to No More Kings over the years. That I don't know exactly where he came across it,
but he probably found it. It wasn't shown to him.
I'm gonna guess he was searching around for stuff and he probably stumbled into it.
Yeah, I'd be curious. Maybe offline, you can send me an email about it. I'm just curious. Because most people obviously come from Sweep the Leg, either having seen the video or that song was in MLB 08, the Sony baseball game. And so a lot of people know it from that. And then recently, a few years ago, it was from an episode of Psych. We had They're Coming to Get You, Barbara, in an episode of Psych. And so
that's
people
right.
find us
yeah.
through that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
And most recently, it's Critical Hit. People are hearing it in the Tiny Tina's Wonderland.
That's right. Yeah. I'd forgotten. I played that and I freaked out when I heard that. I totally forgot. I play a lot of games, and so I just that game was a year or two ago now, and I'd mm-hmm. totally forgotten that. But yeah, I was jumping up and down when that
right?
Came on.
I always love moments like that because we're a really small band. You know, we're about as indie as it gets. And right. so when we have any mild mainstream moment like that, where if you're a fan and you see that, you're like, holy crap, that's the tiny little band I know about.
Right. Right.
And then to your other question. So we haven't had an album in like 10 years, and we questioned whether or not we were going to make new music because, you know, like I said, we're really small, we're indie, we don't really make anything from this. So like, it's hard to justify spending, you know, $20,000 on an album and then it doesn't make anything, especially these days where people, and I'm not complaining about this because I understand the landscape has shifted, but people don't buy music. And so, and Spotify, you know, we're still trying to figure out how to make that. But anyway, my point is, I decided that it's worth it to put something out for the people that have, you know, been patiently fans for years, mm-hmm. or, and also the new people finding us, and there's only three albums they can listen to. Like it just didn't feel like enough to me. So anyway, we are going to keep making music, and I'll figure out a way to make it make sense.
Right.
But our next album will be an EP, a short, probably 4 or 5 song EP, specifically about Back to the Future. It's called right. NMK Back.
Back. Yeah. I like it. And to answer your question, because Mike is such a lightning fast texter, he says, I got a gift card to a music store in town, and they had your first album there, and I saw the Karate Kid homage in the title, and I thought that looked like my thing.
Perfect.
So
that's great. So he actually found it just based on the
Brain
kick on the cover.
Like I said, if it wasn't that, I could see him searching like things on Google or whatever, stumbling across it and going, yep, that's my thing. But yeah, that totally makes sense for Mike. So
that's awesome. That's really awesome.
All right. Well, you've got a couple of things I wanted to shout out and mention here. You're on Patreon. So if you go to www.patreon.com/nomorekings, you will find Pete here on there. And there's a couple of different memberships that you can subscribe to. I think they're everything from like $2 to maybe $50 a month or something like that. And there's a lot of different options and things that you can consider. The $5 one is, I think you get to see all the videos that you're putting up and all that kind of stuff. So that would be a good place to start, probably, at least if you want to see some, like if you like this kind of content, then you go there and you're going to find more specific kind of in-depth stuff about the different songs that you're putting up about once a month or so. And so there's all kinds of goodies and stuff on there. But if you want to dive in a little deeper, you can get like the Write Me a Letter, where you'll send out like a mail package or something to
people. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, prints, stickers, pins, magnets, buttons, that kind of stuff. Sometimes I send out a T-shirt.
Yeah. So there's lots of options and value there for if you're a fan of No More Kings, or if you're interested in No More Kings and you're not a fan yet, you can go and find more kind of stuff on there. And then also you're on Etsy, which is, I think, where you're selling most of your CDs and your prints and T-shirts these days. And so that's Etsy. The link is kind of like dirty, but it's Daspetey, right? Daspetey. Yep. So if you go to Etsy and search for that, I'm sure you can find it, and he'll come up as Pete Mitchell, if you're looking closely enough. And then there's all kinds of T-shirts and stickers and prints. It looks like you sell artwork and other things too. CDs, you can get some signed CDs like I did. And, there's all kinds of stuff that you can go through on there, and just, like I said, all kinds of value for longtime fans, or if you're new and you want to see what all kinds of stuff, there's like literally pages of things on here that you can go through and look at. So I strongly encourage you to check out both of those websites, but also you're streaming on Spotify, and I assume like Apple Music, and just we're about
anywhere
that you can find. So and then you've also got a YouTube channel that you put some stuff up on, and there's lots of videos on there. If you're not in a position to be on Patreon, there's lots of stuff on your YouTube account. And your YouTube account, is it No More Kings on YouTube?
I think it's just No More Kings. Yeah, YouTube/No More Kings. Might it be No More Kings Music? Let me check real quick.
Yeah, no, I see it as at No More Kings, all one word, all over.
Perfect.
Case. So, and then also if you just type in No More Kings, you also get the Schoolhouse Rock thing like right above your your page, so people can watch that and get the reference and then go and click through all your all your videos. There's lots of stuff on there. There's stuff with Neil, and there's other kind of background, kind of behind the scenes things. You've got the Alone in Graceland music video up.
Oh
now.
Yeah, that video.
And that video was so cool, I thought, in a lot of ways.
Thanks, man.
And I thought it was funny. Like, I think you described it as a super cool like pop up book, and then you burned it to the ground.
yeah, we destroy it.
Right. So please feel free to go and check all that kind of stuff out, because I think there's a lot of value for people to go and watch and get more in-depth stuff. And then, and another thing that comes with the Patreon is the Discord server, right? So you can find the Discord server. And then if people wanted to find you and ask a question once in a while, you pop in and talk to people.
Yeah, there's Ask NMK.
Yeah.
Subchannel in there. I'm trying to figure out how to make Discord more interesting, because I love possibilities there. I love that you can have, we've done a Q&A on there that was a lot like this. Mm-hmm. Where like 20 people could just sit there and just ask questions, and we take turns and I go through, but right. You can do stages and there's so much. I haven't really need to dive in a little bit more and really figure out to make it special, but I really like it. I really like the possibility.
Yeah. There's certainly possibilities for fun and lots of avenues to get that done on Discord. So I would encourage anybody listening to this to go and check all those things out. And then you can also check out Michael's Mixdown pretty much anywhere where you get a podcast. So right here in your podcast player, or if you're having to be listening to this on the Spotify for podcasters, like the free version, there should be links. So if you would rather listen to it on like Apple Music or whatever, you can find it pretty much anywhere. And I'm also on Facebook, and you can find me at Michael's Mixdown on TikTok. I make some videos sometimes, and sometimes there's little previews of episodes, and then a lot of times there's just content of dogs, because people seem to like that kind of thing. So, in fact, a lot of my videos, so these episodes tend to be, about an hour or so. And then, so when I try to do these like little snippets, or I try to explain like kind of what went into the episodes, they end up being, 5 to 10 minutes long. And on TikTok, it's hard to get anybody to watch anything longer than like 20 seconds. And so I will throw in a bonus dog video like at the end, bonus puppies, I call them. So
love it.
All right, Pete, thank you. I can't thank you enough for carving out a little bit of time for me here. And then all the, of course, the prep work that kind of went into this over the last couple of weeks and getting this all organized. So thank you so much for all your time. And the CDs that I got today, which were very cool and signed, and that was very, very awesome to get. And so I will be getting those tracks so I can use them for the episode here soon.
Awesome. And,
I hope that this will come out here pretty soon, because I'm pretty excited. So I'm going to probably work on the editing phase here pretty soon. So like I said, thank you so much for coming on and spending so much of your time with me.
Oh, absolutely, Michael. Thank you so much for asking me. This was sincerely a blast.
Yeah, thanks, man.
No dragon, mess with the dragon. So long, my girl.